And so if you think about displacing 4 hours worth of acres, yeah, we probably planted those 4 hours worth of acres the next day, but what you would have planted the next day gets pushed back a day in domino effect. You know, if you let's just say you're going to finish on May 25th, now you're going to finish on May 26th or June 1st, you know, whatever the case may be. And we understand that there is a yield penalty for not putting seed in the ground at the best time of year. That's why, you know, a garden, we plant a garden that's same time every year. We put seed in the ground for corn in, for the most part, May. And if we wait a week, if we wait 2 weeks, you know, the yield has a lower expected potential harvestable yield. And we looked at that, and conservative estimates are, you know, $500 million.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Boost your yields with KWS Hybrid Rye featuring Pollen Plus technology. Learn more at kws.com.
Welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show by Wisenetics. I'm your host, Leo Bastos, Assistant Professor of Integrative Precision Agriculture at the University of Georgia. Today's episode is part of a special series on corn production, and it is with great honor that I welcome our guest, Dr. Terry Griffin. Terry is a professor and precision agriculture economist at Kansas State University. Terry, welcome to the Crop Science Podcast Show. It's great to have you here with us today. And as usual, the first thing I want to ask you is if you can share with us a little bit about your path and how you got to where you are today.
Thanks, Leo. It's great to be here today, and it's an honor on my part to participate in this series of podcasts. You know, one of the things I tell my kids as they're looking into their futures now that they're college age is I wound up in a really good place, but this never was in my plan. I did not plan to be here. And just because our plans fall through doesn't mean it's a bad thing. Sometimes we wind up in a place maybe better than we had anticipated, you know, if we get to choose our entire lives without any obstacles. So I grew up in Northeast Arkansas, not very far from the Mississippi River, in the Mississippi portal, Delta portal, on the rice, cotton, soybean, corn, grain, sorghum, kind of a diversified farm. And I went to University of Arkansas. Well, let me back up. I went to Arkansas State University for a few years. I'll say I went there. I was enrolled. I didn't go there very often. I spent, it's kind of like 13th and 14th grade. You know, when I did go to class, it was largely the same people I went to high school with and my hometown. And I spent more time, you know, trying to do things on the farm than I probably should have. After that, I did go to University of Arkansas, and I graduated with a degree in, I think at the time, it was crop and soil science. It was a degree in agronomy. They changed the name of it about that time I was there. And I got my master's degree from there as well. We call it Fayetteville, University of Arkansas. And I got my master's degree in agricultural economics. And I was looking at how farmers were using precision agriculture at that time. This was in the 1990s, shortly after GPS became available for civilian uses. So that was pretty interesting to me. It was new. Then after I graduated, I went to University of Illinois. I was a farm management extension specialist there for 4 years. In the western part of the state, a little town called Macomb, home of Western Illinois University, a largely corn and soybean part of the world, you know, the Eastern Corn Belt. I did that for 4 years, and then I decided I wanted a PhD. I wanted to be able to focus on how to utilize geo-reference data coming from combines, you know, precision ag data. And so I went to Purdue and got a PhD in agriculture economics. I focused on spatial econometrics, which means I look at data from a statistical point of view and try to explicitly model the spatial structure across landscapes. You know, this is the type of data that violates all the classical assumptions, so we need to treat it a little bit differently. And after that, I went back home, University of Arkansas. I did that for around 5 years or so. And I did farm management work as an extension specialist. 11 years ago, almost, I came here to Kansas State University. And I've been here for, 10 and a half years. Wow. And my kids are kind of grown up here. So I'm a farm management extension specialist. I use the phrase extension precision agricultural economist. And sometimes I use the phrase space weather economist because in the last 5 years, I've been working with a space weather scientist, and there's very few economists, agricultural or otherwise, working in this area, very few social scientists. And I'm here. And if you look, some of my background, I kind of skipped over. My personal email address, my personal website is Space Plowboy. So if you go to spaceplowboy.com, that's me. That's my email address. Astronomy has been one of my oldest hobbies. I remember when shortly after the Voyager launches in the 1970s, and you were sending back high resolution imagery of Jupiter. And I just sort of fell in love with that. I've had telescopes my entire life, and it's sort of a family hobby now. And so I've always worked in precision agriculture professionally. And then in 2020, had some colleagues reach out to me. I didn't know them at the time. And they said, hey, we would like to do something. They were in space weather. They wanted to do something in agriculture. And I thought, well, this is a great opportunity. I get to meld my professional career with my personal interests, hobbies. And not only that, it wasn't just a hobby. I mean, I learned so much about what space weather is and the physics behind it in the last 5 years that it's become the thrust of my program. And there's so much work to be done. And it's not just a intangible. And we're seeing real world problems for end users in agriculture, construction, mining, oil and gas exploration with GPS issues that are caused by space weather. And, you know, for a lot of agriculturalists last year on May 9th, they had no idea that space weather could affect GPS. The morning of May 11th, they became a lot more aware of this could potentially be a problem. And so it's kept me busy for the last 5 years, but in particular for the last 18 months.
Fantastic. That's amazing. We know each other from other times, and I was not aware of this great story and trajectory you had until getting to K-State. So that's very, very nice. Thanks for sharing that. And, you know, Terry has done amazing work in many aspects of precision ag economics and other areas as well. And today, specifically, we're going to be targeting space weather, which is something that I've been fascinated by learning more about it through your talks and interactions with you. And at least my understanding is that most people, even in research and even in precision ag, may not be aware of it. So it's a very interesting topic that definitely deserves much more attention. And I'm glad we're doing this episode today so we can spread the word. So to follow all that up, can you define space weather? You know, I think that word is very intriguing, and people may have some different misconceptions perhaps of what it means. So can you just help us here understand what does space weather mean?
Yeah, it's not just one thing. You know, it's an interaction among several phenomena, and largely has to do with our sun, you know, from solar activity. You know, there can be events at the sun. You know, I think most people are familiar with sunspots. You know, if they see images of the sun in some dark places on the surface, those are sunspots. And historically, that's why scientists have counted the number of sunspots on the surface when it comes to the sunspot cycle. And this has been religiously measured since the mid-1700s. So we have a few hundred years of daily sunspot counts. And it happens in a cycle. Every 11 years, the number of sunspots peak. And every 11 years, the number of sunspots hit a minimum as well. It follows a cycle really well. And it's not just, you know, solar effects. We have the galactic cosmic rays coming in from outer space. And those are high when the sunspot count is low. And when a sunspot count gets high, there's more activity at the sun, and it pushes the galactic cosmic rays coming from outer space back away. And so there's interaction there. The Earth has a geomagnetic field, and we have a North Pole, we have a South Pole. And many of our audience will be familiar with the Northern Lights, the Southern Lights, the Aurora Borealis or Australis. And that is a visual of the geomagnetic field that the Earth has. Okay? And all these things play together. And so for GPS, space weather is a couple of things can happen. The most common happens in the ionosphere. You know, our audience may be familiar with, you know, that's a layer pretty high up in our atmosphere that has ionized particles, or I'm not a physicist, it may be atoms, molecules, they're ionized something. And radio waves, high-frequency radio waves from satellites come through that to reach the Earth. And during geomagnetic disturbances, that layer of ionosphere may become more dense than at other times. And so if you've ever taken a bottle of water, or a glass of water, and move it in front of an object and see how the light is moved, you know, you see those little things with people's heads look like they're not attached to their bodies if they're in a swimming pool at a certain angle because the light gets refracted. It's the same concept. And when high-frequency radio waves from GPS satellites take a few more milliseconds to get to the surface of the Earth's surface, the GPS receiver cannot make an accurate location lock. And so sometimes there may be an error of feet, you know, several yards, or it might be just impossible to get a GPS lock at all. And so that's the type of space weather that's affecting us in with GPS. Last year, on May 10th, there's sunspots. We call them active regions. There was a few big ones. They were visible with naked eye. When I say naked eye, I want to emphasize, don't go stare at the sun with naked eyes. Use eclipse glasses. When I mean by naked eye, it did not require any magnification. So with just eclipse glasses, we went outside, we could see the sunspots. There were two active regions, and they merged together. And they were, you know, larger than the Earth. And as though those regions that were the source, the origin of several space weather events, there were sometimes we think of solar flares, which is a bright spot all of a sudden. Sometimes those flares are associated with the actual mass from the sun getting shot into space. And we refer to that as coronal mass ejections. We just call them CMEs. But the idea is that the surface of the sun is the corona, and there's actual particles with mass that leave the sun's surface from a violent reaction of some sort. And those things move slower than the speed of light. And we can see it leave the sun about 8 minutes after it happens because, you know, the sun's far enough away that the speed of light, it takes 8 minutes and 20 seconds to get to the Earth. Well, the coronal mass that reaches us takes about a day and a half at the earliest, maybe 2 to 3 days, depending on how fast it's moving. And that's what really gets our atmosphere excited, is that actual mass when it hits us. And it's large, and it has its own magnetic field. And if the magnetic field of that coronal mass ejection is aligned with the Earth's magnetic field, you know, Earth's north is up, let's say, it'd be like a refrigerator magnet, you know, slapping into each other. And that would make a beautiful aurora borealis. And also causes us problems with communications and with high frequency radio waves.
This is fantastic. And it is It is so amazing because it's something that we are, at least most of us, the majority of the population is probably completely unaware of because it doesn't directly affect us most of the time. But when it does affect, especially in agriculture, can be a very big deal, right? So you made a mention of May 10th of 2024. Can you tell us, you know, I think you maybe already mentioned what happened from the space weather perspective, but what were the consequences of it and why should we care about it?
So on May 7th, there were two active regions that kind of merged together on the southwest limb of the sun. And when you think about east and west in space, you got to do it reverse because we're used to looking at east and west, looking down on the Earth. If we look up in a planet or the sun, we get a reversed east and west in our mind. That happened on May 7th. They fused together on May 8th, May 9th. And then on May 10th and 11th, we had storms, solar storms that arrived at the Earth. And the coronal mass ejection, we didn't just have one. We had at least three, maybe more. And the first one was moving pretty fast. The second one was moving faster. And the third one was moving faster. So they compressed in space between the Earth and the sun heading towards the Earth. And when they got to us, they were highly polarized with its own magnetic field. We saw lots of things happen. In the United States, we started getting reports in North Dakota first. You know, usually it's the northern latitudes, or if you're in the southern hemisphere, be the, you know, the high latitudes, which would be closer to the South Pole. Usually those happen, you know, we get reports from there first. But this one, you know, it started in North Dakota, and we had a good 3-4 hours of questionable GPS that afternoon on May 10th, evening, the Friday of May 10th. Where you are in Georgia, we had lots of reports down the eastern seaboard. We had reports in Tifton, Georgia, at the experiment station at ABEC, that RTK was inoperative. And so that's pretty far south when you start thinking about these types of events. We had aurora borealis, northern lights being, you know, photographed with palm trees in the foreground in Florida. You know, and that's pretty severe. And that day we had, NOAA, which is, the National Weather Service, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a group called the Space Weather Prediction Center. And, you know, I encourage our audience, and I always tell farmers this, you know, if you're having problems with GPS, go to the SWPC Space Weather Prediction Center website, spaceweather.gov. And, you know, look at these charts. And one of the charts is the planetary K index. It goes from 0 to 9. Anything below 5 is not a geomagnetic disturbance. We hit 9 that day. And the storms are listed from G1 to G5. G5 being the most severe. It's actually cut extreme. We hit G5. It barely made a G5. I want to emphasize that. There's a whole bunch more of space capacity to be a G5 that's much more severe. We barely hit G5 that day, but it was a G5. There's a really good chance that we'll have additional storms like that that would be more severe than we experienced on May 10th and May 11th of 2024.
That's amazing. Thanks for sharing all that. You know, if we think about this, so we had this event that happened on May 10th last year, that we felt the implications on May 10th last year. And it's probably something that we haven't seen as frequently in the past yet, or at least in the past that we were able to feel the implications of something like this. So one may think, well, that's a pretty rare event. It's probably not going to happen anymore. Why worry about it? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, and I thought about that quite a bit. So right now we're in solar cycle number 25. And remember that each solar cycle is about 11 years long. And we've, as a society, started measuring these in 1750. That was solar cycle one, and that's how we started numbering these. We're in number 25. Okay, number 25 is sort of an average solar cycle. It's nothing different about this one. It's pretty normal. The previous solar cycle, 24, was very, very mild. It's one of the most mild solar cycles in history, given the number of sunspots that were counted, given the number of days that had a geomagnetic disturbance, is really mild. The previous one before that was solar cycle 23. It's from the late 90s until about 2008. It was, an average solar cycle. But if you look at the adoption of GPS around the year 2000, especially in agriculture, we're looking at less than 5% of planted acres had any GPS technology on it. And matter of fact, that was the year 2000 was when President Clinton signed something, maybe an executive order, maybe I can't remember exactly the type of article he signed, but it turned off selective availability, which before then introduced a intentional error in the GPS. And they said, well, let's just turn this completely off. And that kind of coincided with GPS being more friendly for civilian uses. So that story tells us, okay, back in solar cycle 23, we had less than 5% of planted acres using GPS. Solar cycle 24 was... some people call it a dud. It's definitely a mild solar cycle. We didn't have any days with a KP of 9. And remember, the K index of 9 is when what we had on the day of May 10th. And it wasn't until May 10th that we actually had GPS in the field and geomagnetic disturbance. And it happened in May, on May 10th. You know, if it happened on December 10th, not a big deal in North America. We're not really doing a lot in the field to plant. Hopefully, we're not harvesting on December 10th. But I guess in Georgia, sometimes you have to with cotton. But for the most part, we're not using GPS a lot in December. And we've had some issues in December with GPS, but just really didn't affect agriculture. If you look at the data going back to 1750, we've had lots of days with geomagnetic disturbances. The 1950s, the 1960s. You know, when the Apollo 11 mission landed on the moon in 1969, and that was at the peak of solar cycle 20, in 1967, there was a solar storm that caused radio disruption events. And one of my colleagues, Doris Knipp, with University of Colorado now, she was on faculty at Air Force Academy for a while. She wrote an article explaining that in May of 1967, there was this solar storm that knocked out radio, disrupted radio. And the Soviets and the United States both thought that the other were interfering in an act of war. We came really close to really bad things happening that day. Thankfully, the Air Force had a sort of a space weather forecasting thing going on, and they stepped in and said, no, we don't think this is nefarious, artificial. We think it's natural. Everybody just kind of, take a deep breath. You know, so that was 1967. That was 10 years, 11 years before the first GPS satellite went up. Okay. In 1972, again, this is Dolores. She knows where all the bones are buried, I guess. She published an article that on August 4th, 1972, an ultra-fast coronal mass ejection hit the Earth and caused underwater mines to explode in North Vietnam. Okay, and that was a big deal. But again, this was 6 years before the first GPS satellite went up. In 1989, the electrical grid in Quebec in Canada was knocked out for two whole days in the city. In rural areas, it's almost 2 weeks because of space weather. And in 2003, I was not aware of this at the time, but this was a Halloween storm. It happened during late October, October 29th, 2003. Half the satellites in orbit deorbited, according to some reports we have here. It was the first X-class solar flare that we had, I think, in that solar cycle 23. So any of those types of storms would have likely been much more severe than what we call the Gannon storm. The Gannon storm was named after Dr. Jennifer Gannon, who unfortunately passed away a few weeks earlier in May of 2024. She was a space weather scientist. So the May 10th storm is named in her honor, the Gannon storm. If those other events had happened in the age of precision ag era, since the dawn of GPS, it would have been a lot more noticeable than the Gannon storm was. So, this is kind of a tongue in cheek, but Mother Nature has been really kind to us since we've been using GPS, and sort of like, okay, we're gonna let you get this thing figured out, but hey, we're gonna get back to a normal solar cycle soon, and these types of events should be something that you need to be more aware of.
This is fantastic. So just to perhaps like a summary of it. So we basically, since we started using GPS in agriculture, we've only really been through one sun cycle that has had larger activity, like what we saw last year. But we know it has happened in the past, and that every 11-year cycles, we have a chance of something like this coming up again. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. So I've got some really nice charts. I don't know if we can put those on the website or not. But yeah, the solar cycle 19, which was the late 50s, early 60s, there was a bunch of days that had a geomagnetic disturbance. And we just haven't had one in the last 30 years. It's just been a calm time for the sun. The sun has been kind of sleepy. But if the sun wakes up and becomes normal or above normal, we're going to see a lot more activity. And it's not just GPS. The airline industry, they change paths, not because of navigation, but because of comms. So typically, if we fly to Europe, we kind of go over the pole. But during May 10th, May 11th, what happened was airlines said, well, we're afraid that if we do that, we're going to lose comms, communications, radio. So we're going to fly to lower altitude and go over the Atlantic Ocean, which burns a lot more fuel that way because it's a longer path and it's more air resistance and so forth. And so is huge implications, not just for GPS users, but for communications. Ham radio operators, they're very sensitive to these things. They're really fun to listen to about geomagnetic disturbances because they can really tell when something's up.
Nice. That's fantastic. And so, so we kind of went through here, what is space weather? What happened last year on May 10th? What caused it? What were some of the implications? But perhaps, if the next thing I want to follow up here is, what were the consequences of what happened last year to those working in agriculture, right? So it happened in May, which is a time of the year that there's a lot of field activity, especially with planting. So can you tell us a little bit about that? What were the consequences, perhaps even the economic impact of something that, like this that happened that we don't often think of?
So in agriculture, if we have a non-agricultural audience, and the history behind that is before GPS, pretty much all row crop planters in the Midwest, the Mid-South, had row markers. And so we have a 6-row, 8-row, 12-row, and rows are basically a yard apart, maybe a meter, And there was these mechanical row markers that would scratch a little path, and that would tell the operator of the machine, okay, I got to straddle this on the way back. This is how they make parallel passes. Well, after the commercialization of automated guidance, it's like, hey, we really don't need these row markers anymore. We just won't buy them when we buy a new planter. And then the next step was, hey, since we don't have to have row markers, why don't we just make a 48-row planter? And those exist. And you probably could put row markers on one of those, but it's borderline infeasible. I mean, it's possible, I suspect, if you're, but the engineering may suggest that'd be a really expensive thing, maybe cheaper to have 224s. Don't know, but the fact is, a lot of planters in the Midwest and Mid-South no longer have row markers. So fast forward to May 10th. You know, I'm planting corn, putting corn seed in the ground with a 48 row, 36 row, even a 12 row. I may not have row markers on it either. And GPS isn't working. Well, what do I do? Do I continue putting seed in the ground that has wide and narrow middles? You know, we call those, there's different nicknames for that type of thing. You know, in some parts of the Midwest or Mid-South too, that, hey, you know, we want the landowner to see that we have crooked rows. I mean, it's frowned upon in a small agricultural community. And one technology, electric drive planters, kind of use that timing from GPS signal to drop seed. And so, you know, there's workarounds. We could get off and replace that with a gear-driven information to put seed in the ground. But there's decisions to be made. You know, do they continue going, even if they were able to make a workaround, or do they wait for GPS to come back? Well, I made the assumption in my analysis that so many acres were going to be affected. And I varied this. You know, you can argue that we got some 12 row, some 24 row planters, and a portion of those would be susceptible to the GPS outage, maybe not all of them. And some places in the Corn Belt, Illinois in particular, was behind schedule because it has been a wet spring. And they were 20% behind schedule in Illinois that weekend. And so if you think about displacing 4 hours worth of acres, yeah, we probably planted those 4 hours worth of acres the next day, but what you would have planted the next day gets pushed back a day in domino effect. You know, let's just say you were going to finish on May 25th, now you're going to finish on May 26th or June 1st, you know, whatever the case may be. And we understand that there is a yield penalty for not putting seed in the ground at the best time of year. That's why, you know, a garden, we plant a garden that's same time every year. We put seed in the ground for corn in, for the most part, May. And if we wait a week, if we wait 2 weeks, you know, the yield has a lower expected potential harvestable yield. And we looked at that, and conservative estimates are, you know, $500 million, you know, $500 million in lost corn production, which seems like a big number, you know, and it is. But if you think about how many acres of corn are in the United States, you know, we got 90-something million acres of corn. So even if we just take away a bushel from every acre, I mean, that's a lot of money, right? $4 times, you know, $100 million acres, that's $400 million right there. But not all acres were affected. And only those four susceptible farms. So it wasn't everybody. But the farms that were affected, you know, we're looking at almost $20,000 per farm, which is real money. And conservative estimates suggest, you know, $500 million. And I don't think it's beyond reason to say it was a flat, cool $1 billion loss that day just for corn production. And when I put that number out, a lot of people get excited. The media loves it when you say there's a $1 billion loss, you know, and that was good for me. NOAA, you know, came to me and said, hey, so what would be the benefit of putting out a forecast? Could we have saved $1 billion? Well, you know, maybe not in that case, because it's kind of like a rainstorm coming. You know, if you knew that GPS was not going to work tomorrow, it doesn't really change what we were going to do, because we're still going to put seed in the ground as quickly as we can, regardless, just like a thunderstorm coming to rain 3 inches. So I thought a lot about that. And that's why I started working on peanuts. You know, in Georgia, where you are, I mean, there's a lot of peanuts in Georgia. Most of them are in Georgia. And the reason I did that was because RTK GPS, which is the most accurate, you know, sub-inch accuracy. But not only is it sub-inch, it's absolute accuracy, meaning that it's not just pass to pass or from day to day. It's, you know, months later or even years later, you should have that same accuracy. And it's really important when planting peanuts and digging peanuts are both on the same RTK line. And it's like geometry, we call it the AB line, from point A to point B, a straight line. Some of our listeners may not realize that peanuts grow underground. I'm learning that a lot of people not familiar with peanuts. And when we plant them in the spring, they become viney. The above ground part becomes viney. We have a hard time seeing where knowing where the underground portion is. And that's why the RTK is so important, to tell the farmer, tell the equipment where the peanuts were planted in order to dig them up. There's a known loss, at least 10%, maybe 15%, that if we don't use RTK for both planting and digging, we leave 15% of the nuts in the ground, not harvested. So the farmer has a choice. Do I give up that 10 to 15% from the digging loss, or do I wait until the outage is over, that RTK outage is over, and then continue planting or digging? And I've estimated that the value of a reliable RTK, I call it a nowcast, not just a forecast, but it's a nowcast because it's an ongoing GPS outage. When will this thing be over? Is, you know, just in Georgia alone is worth $20 million just for that information.
That's amazing, right? I mean, putting those numbers and really understanding the impact of something that first we normally don't think of, because at least since we've been using GPS, hasn't happened as frequently. And just understanding the impact of that, it's really, really impressive. So, okay. So that, you know, I know we're going a little bit over time here, but this conversation is so good. This will be one of the episodes I go over. All right. So, you know, let's say there is a system that can forecast and provide growers with the information of, okay, we're going to have GPS signal problems in the coming days, right? What are the options that growers have? Because, I mean, especially as you said, perhaps this happens in the time of the year where there's not much field activity going on. So maybe growers would not even care about that. But if it does happen in one of those key moments of the growing season where growers need to be out and using equipment with precise location of what they're doing, what can they do about this? If they know something's coming, how can they prepare? Is there even a way to counteract that effect? To I guess do something about it?
I think about that quite a bit, and I don't really have a really fun, happy answer to that. So that's why I went to the peanuts, because there is a actionable decision at planting time. A farmer has a choice between the lesser of two evils. Every 11 years, we have a solar max, and it's not just 1 year. It lasts, you know, let's say 3 years. We have three seasons of solar max together, and then it kind of quietens down. Well, you know, does it make sense for us to keep a small planter, maybe an eight-row planter with row markers if we're used to using a 48-row? Well, you know, the benefits of having that 48-row planter, being able to cover, you know, 60, 70 acres an hour during the good times, far more offsets the downtime in that 1 year out of X number. Okay. So my recommendation is not to go around and keep row markers, because the expected value of doing so will not make up for the cost of doing so. GPS, there's been some improvements, and I've been using the phrase GPS because that's familiar. It's easy to say, global positioning system. This was the first of a handful of systems that are available. It's the United States Department of Defense or Department of War, whatever it's called right now. It is, the generic phrase is GNSS, Global Navigation Satellite System. And that would include the American GPS system, the Russian GLONASS, the European Galileo, and the Chinese system. And those are four global navigation systems that many of the newer agricultural GPS receivers can use for multiple signals. And the newer GPS receivers tend to be less susceptible than the single, the L1s, which were only GPS. Now, I say that, but if it's a mild ionospheric geomagnetic disturbance, you know, that would help. But if it's a extreme geomagnetic disturbance, it doesn't matter because we're just not getting GPS signals to the ground in any orderly fashion at all. Some of the newer technology does have some more correction when there's, but it depends. There's some dual phase GPS that were supposed to help, but if you're on that verge between no disturbance and if you're at the gradient where there is a lot of disturbance, sometimes a dual phase will actually be worse off than a single phase. There's so many use cases that we can come up with an exception that, well, you know, maybe not all the time. So the question I get in my head is, well, what's after GPS? You know, GPS has been around for a while. You know, the first satellite went up in 1978. That's before, you know, a lot of our farmers were even born, you know. So it's not necessarily new technology. You know, what's coming out new next? You know, I've been reading about quantum guidance, which is sort of the next idea that doesn't require high-frequency radio waves coming through the atmosphere. You know, that might be the net answer to the problem, but that's not going to happen now. It may, you know, if we're fortunate, to happen before the next solar cycle maximum in a decade from now. But we don't have really good answers to that. But I'm going to back up and say, as a economist, I'm a social scientist. I work with hard numbers, but I'm still yet a social scientist. I care about how people make decisions under risk. And the first 30 minutes of a GPS outage is the most critical reason. Reason is that's when people panic. That's when they get upset. That's when they start cutting wires, trying to make, you know, figure things out. And if it's not a local problem, you know, ripping wires off the tractor is not going to help. Okay. And I've talked to a few people who said that they got into some arguments, heated arguments with their, you know, business partners, spouses, whatnot, because, you know, we in the year 2025, we expect our cell phones to work immediately without question. We expect technology to work, you know, 24/7, 365. And if when it doesn't, we get frustrated. Right? The frustration leads to problems. And that's why I offer to our audience, to farmers, to practitioners of end users of GPS, hey, we got some really good websites from NOAA, Space Weather Prediction Center, spaceweather.gov is one of them. Take a look at it. If it's got some red bars, dark orange bars on that planetary K-index chart, it's probably not a local problem, probably nothing that you, the dealer, or anybody you know can do anything about. You know, if you got to have GPS to operate and it's not working and the bars are red on that chart, you know, go have an early lunch, you know, go to a movie, you know, just do something. Don't get all upset. I think that's the biggest takeaway message about what can we do if we know that there is a GPS outage.
Perfect. That's awesome. And I think, you know, something you said, I think is really important is just to understand. Right. I mean, as we get frustrated, understand first if there is something that anyone can do about it, because our expectation is that, yes, somebody should be able to do something about it. But if something that nobody can do something about it, then, yeah, I mean, let's not burn bridges and get into arguments and fights that are not going to solve the problem because it's not within the scope of anyone to be able to fix.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence. Starting now.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up the first part of our episode. So, Terry, thank you so much. This was great conversation. And now we're going to get into the last three questions that we ask every guest in this episode. Before we do that, I want to invite our audience, if you're enjoying this conversation, make sure to like us, subscribe us, share this episode with other people. Every guest we have in this podcast, I always learn a lot with them and this very interesting conversations. And this one specific is a very different topic, right? So it's something that probably not a lot of people are aware of. And as Terry was explaining, can have a big impact when it happens, if it happens at a key time for our producers. So please make sure to share that so other people can also learn more about this. All right, Terry. So we got to the last three questions of our episode. The first one is, if you have a resource, a technical resource, so related to agriculture, precision ag, economics, space weather, anything of that sort that you could share with our audience.
So one of the things I think about is, when it comes to economics, how do people make decisions? And something that is friendly to the masses, whether they're an agriculturalist or some other field. I'm sure you're familiar with it. There's a book and set of podcasts called Freakonomics. And I find those really useful because the hosts present that in such a way that it helps us think about how people make decisions that may not seem rational on the surface, but yet they do make a lot more sense once you understand what they've got going on. So I've enjoyed reading those books and listening to their podcast, Freakonomics.
Freakonomics. Nice. I'm not aware of that, but we'll definitely check them out. Thanks for the suggestion. All right. So our second question of the three is very similar. Resource that you have used and could share with us, but outside of the technical area.
I've been really pondering that question. Most of what I read is, let me back, most of what I read is my own writing when I'm revising it. I don't read for fun. You know, I think a lot of academics probably don't. And I'm going to give you the same answer, the Freakonomics, because it has a few things like game theory. One piece of game theory is called the prisoner's dilemma. And I use that when I'm talking about farm data and joining farm data aggregation groups. And I think it's important to understand that people don't always do what is best. They wind up in the corner of the world we call it equilibrium. And equilibrium is sort of, once you get there, you know, there's a better place to be, but it's not a feasible place to get to. And the prisoner's dilemma, you know, is a fun thing to read about from game theory. You know, there was a movie that came out 25 years ago called A Beautiful Mind about a Nobel Peace Prize winner named John Nash, who was a mathematician, economist, who I was given credit for developing in these ideas. A Beautiful Mind is the homework I want to assign to our audience, and it does talk about game theory.
Nice. Fantastic. Thanks for sharing that. And the last of the three is, what skills or skill set do you think, or have you observed in successful professionals around you?
So this one I feel pretty strongly about. I get pushback on this all the time. I think the greatest thing a professional can do is not be a cookie cutter of others. You know, we see this in departments all the time. It's like, we got to have a professor that does A. We got to have a professor that does B. You know, in another university, they have a professor that does A, they have a professor that does B. And, you know, 50 years ago, that made a lot of sense. But today with, you know, you and I are across the country from each other. We're discussing face-to-face right now. You know, so the idea of every university, every department having, you know, a cookie cutter set of specialists, I think is a day gone by. And for instance, space weather, you know, that's one of the things. I'm one of the few agriculturalists, one of the few economists anywhere in the world who's working on it. And I think that's an important thing to do is, you know, bring something unique to the multi-state table or the international table. You know, we can't all be the same clones of one another.
Nice. And, you know, I when you were explaining this, that one of your hobbies before this came up to you as an opportunity, one of your long life hobbies was astrology. I thought, man, that's such a nice way of interest combining, right? It's such a unique set of interests that combine in the same person on the same time. And they had this great opportunity to pursue. So that's...
Yeah, and it's been a family hobby, too. And so last year, NOAA has a space weather workshop every year. And I've never heard of it until last year. And so it happened during our spring break. So my high school and college students, my own children were out of school. So we all loaded up and drove to Boulder. And all three of my children presented posters at the space weather workshop. You know, so they had this student section. You know, they had one for high. They even had this opening for high school students. And my daughter was the first one who's ever raised her hand and said, "Hey, I'm a high school student. I want to participate." And so all four of us had posters. Plus, I had a presentation to the general group. Yeah, it was an excellent family hobby, family activity, and it was a lot of fun because it was fairly technical, but yet it was very entertaining, very fun for us.
Nice. Amazing. Well, Terry, thank you so much for being our guest today and sharing all this great information. Although I have seen and read some of it before, but I learned a lot about space weather and definitely am more informed when talking with the growers I work with here in Georgia. So thank you so much. It was a great time.
Thank you, Leo, for having me. It was my honor.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.